let the music play on. Everybody sing, everybody dance. Lose yourself in wild romance. We're going to party, caramba, fiesta, forever. Come on and sing along. We're going to party, caramba, fiesta. Come on and sing along, all night long, all night.
Welcome everyone to the season finale of Smooth Sailing 2. It is a beautiful gray day outside in Milwaukee as we broadcast from room 1116 of the Margaret Locke Hall at the MSOE campus. Today's guest on Smooth Sailing will be Dr. Brian Faulkner of the EE department at MSOE. Dr. Faulkner, are you there?
Hello, can you hear me?
Yes, I can. Dr. Faulkner, what's your favorite kind of weather?
Let me think for a second. I like the summer days that have a really strong breeze, so I can think about those people who go parasailing and they can like fly on the wind for a short time. I like those.
Yes. I know exactly what weather you're talking about. I don't like humidity, personally.
Not a fan.
Anyways, how have you been, Dr. Faulkner?
It's been quite the year. I had my first baby about a year and a month ago. And, you know, the year's been weird for everybody, but it seems like things are returning to normalcy, so.
Yeah, thankfully. Congrats. And yeah. I suppose I want to just ask, you've been teaching at MSOE for 2 years, is that correct?
Yeah, it's the end of my second year teaching at MSOE. I taught for a year at Rose Holman Institute of Technology down in Indiana as a visiting professor before that.
So I really have to ask, since you're the first professor I've had on this program, how strange has it been switching to the online format, and how do you feel about the transition now that all is said and done and we can really start to look back on just everything that shifted this past year?
I would say definitely not a fan. My ability to pick up on nonverbal cues of student understanding has gone down to approximately zero. So all of the blank stares and fidgeting that used to warn me that people don't know what's going on, you need to slow down, all of that is gone. Students have just less resources with which to complete everything, and I have less resources with which to teach. So it's sort of an X squared reduction in total learning. Doing it did push me into using a couple of tools that I'm going to keep using. I started using Gradescope to do stuff because Canvas is terrible.
Yes.
I'm pretty sure it was bad design 20 years ago when it came out, and it's horrible design by modern user interface standards.
You get what you pay for. How much does it cost to use Canvas as an organization? Do you
I
know?
Have no idea. Any amount is too much.
It's not worth it free. Certainly not what for whatever MSOE is paying for it.
I do not like it. I think that like software design and user interface design has evolved a ton since it came out, and I don't think it was. It's bloated with a million buttons that only one out of every 20 classes even uses. And it's the user interface is not good.
Mm-hmm. Though I do want to bring up something that you said So you can't really interact with any of, or you can't read a room very successfully online. However, are more or less people showing up to office hours this year than in previous years? Since it's online, it should be more accessible, but...
I'd say, for me personally, about the same as previously. Mm-hmm. Depending on the class, I'd usually get... during normal times, I hold my office hours in the library study room. So, because that's where all the students are going to be anyway, and my office personally is tiny. And there's not really room for me and another full-size human being in there. So I hold my office hours in the library, and then I can have six students all come at the same time, and it's no additional burden on... Hey, girls, quiet girls, hush. It's no additional cramping, and there's no lines or anything. I'd say I got, like, my E2060 AC circuits class. I had really healthy office hours attendance this winter. Maybe a little bit thinner in a couple of my other classes, but I think it was more accessible, but I think students also had more going on that competed with that.
Yes. I cannot confirm this first year here, but it feels as if a lot of things either intentionally or unintentionally overlapped this year. Because everything was online, there was a generally less cohesive sense of coordination between organization and academics this year. I can't confirm or say anything if it's always been that way, but it's just been an organizational nightmare for me as a student being online, which is odd. You think it would be a lot easier since you have all of your resources digitally, but it's... I like to think that it's something related to the rut of sorts. When you're online, everything can change day to day, but when you're physically there, you're going through a rut usually. You have a routine, but now the routine is just out the window.
Yeah, that's the thing I definitely noticed, that there's a lot of students that, like, just with things like due dates, that you'd be, I don't know, playing disc golf with your friends. You're like, hey, man, what did you get for that third problem on thermo homework that's due today? That was really hard. And then you're like, wait a minute, there's thermo homework today? Those interactions don't happen with nearly the frequency in the online environment. And I know, you know, I just set my classes that every single week's due dates are always identical. So that way there's just one less thing to remember, because there's a bazillion little fiddly bits taking up brain space, and I want as much of the brain space available to be used on important stuff, not remembering, oh, every other week the homework is due on Thursdays, and then all the even numbered weeks it's due on Wednesdays, and that's just it just creates a lot of stuff.
And it's I know personally for me, one of the biggest hindrances to my education this year has been handouts in specific, when you have half the class coming one day and half the class coming the next day, and that first class is going to get the handout a day sooner, so they have a day sooner to do the assignment, or they're just waiting for an assignment to be posted on Canvas, since they're not going to get it that weekend, and one class got on paper and the other didn't, which leads back to what you said about, hey, did you do this homework? You're not going to have something physical to show.
The passive cues, just like the, you know, I can't observe the passive cues of people are confused. The students also are lacking the passive cues from their peers of, oh, I need to do something, because everyone's, you know, in their own little box.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's good that it's almost over now.
Yeah. We're the public announced plan is that things are going to be back to normal in the fall, and I'm ready to see my students' faces again.
Mm-hmm. Some of them. I'm sure some will keep their mask on. Maybe.
Even just seeing furrowed brows is going to do a lot.
And fidgeting hands.
Yeah.
which will be good. Mm. While we're on the topic of education, I heard yesterday that we have a new EECS department chair.
Oh, yeah. Dr. Ross has been promoted from EE program director to EECS department chair.
Yep. I know a lot about the upper process and the retirement and how everything shifted around up there, but is there any insight to going on what's going to happen with the EE department? Sorry.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, with the chair and specific for the program director.
Yeah, so we're, so with Dr. Ross moving, so with Dr. Williams moving up a rank into a dean level position, that left a vacancy that now Dr. Ross has filled, which now leaves a vacancy for EE program director, which she put out an announcement on our department teams saying, all right, send me your, if you want to take the position, send your applications. That is not, there is not even a short list on that just yet, because the announcement just went public just shortly ago.
There any, I don't know what the proper term is to put this, any updates that's going to happen to scheduler or any of the schedules coming out? Because I know I had a Ross section personally, and I got a heads up the day before it happened, and I switched sections out of that class because I didn't know if it was going to exist or not.
Yeah, I don't think that those decisions have been made yet. So I don't know what's going to happen with scheduling. I do know that I'll be taking over as the coordinator for EE1000, which has been Dr. Ross's responsibility. And with her moving up to a higher rank, that I'm going to be taking over being in charge of EE1000 and making sure all of that runs lockstep the way it does.
Got it. Is this information publicly available, or is this something that the EE students will just have to wait to see until next year?
Yeah, that's stuff that's wait and see. Like, I mean, I'm going to take doing that, but I don't know what's going to happen with scheduling. I think a lot of those decisions have yet to be made.
Mm-hmm. Understandable. Lots of shifts happening.
Mm-hmm.
Anyways, I'm going to now move on to a brief Q&A session if anyone has any questions for Dr. Faulkner before I get into mine. Go ahead and post them in general or speak up now. I have one from Mitch Hendricks, our quote-unquote station technician. It is a bit of a joke question. Are you familiar with the Pokemon series released by Nintendo?
Oh, yeah. I caught them all on Blue Version and Gold Version. No Game Genie.
Mitchell Hendricks asks, how in the Pokemon series do electric types work?
Oh.
Specifically, in being effective against water and air, as air is a very good insulator. I kind of expanded his question.
And the thing is, normal water is actually just a so-so conductor. But salt water is a good conductor, and I think the flying types being weak to electric type is that, like, airplanes can get hit by lightning? Like, it doesn't really make sense, but, I mean, dragon type having an advantage against anything doesn't make any sense, so. Ice on dragon? Like, what's that?
That doesn't make any sense, and what also doesn't make any sense is conducting Pokemon, steel types aren't weak against electric.
Yeah, steel type being weak to electric would be like, that would make sense. Like, oh, earth is a meh conductor, so earth is resistant to electricity. That makes some sense, because, like, you know, and like, oh, the idea of grounding something, it's like a cute little joke.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's just some of the type. And I know, like, I stopped playing at Gold Version, which was, I don't know, I'm old years ago. But and then they added what, like fairy type, and they had another because like dark and steel were around when I was playing, yeah. And then I think they added like two more types.
I'm not as much of an expert as Mitch, but I know fairy was added, and the big thing with fairy when it came out, and I was also getting out of Pokemon at the time that came out, because this franchise is going for. Did it have its?
I was in fourth grade.
Yeah,
Pokemon
I think
Hepper
I was
going to
say the 30th or 25th anniversary was like last year.
Yeah, I got like I remember very distinctly the first time I saw a Pokemon out, which was on the back of a Lunchable when I was in the grocery store with my parents when I was in fourth grade. Like, I have this crystallized memory of Poliwhirl, and that was my favorite Pokemon because it was the first one I ever saw.
I have something very similar. I didn't grow up with Pokemon, despite it being a very established... I think it's the number one grossing... property, I want to say, in the world, like, individually grossing. I'll need to look that up, but I feel like that's true. But anyways, my parents, despite the Pokemon, like, satanic panic or something, that briefly happened in the late 90s, I believe.
Oh, yeah. My friend's mom made him throw away all his Pokemon cards because of that.
My parents still didn't let me like touch any of the games because of that, basically, until I was maybe close to 13. No, yeah, 12 or 13. And this was in the late 2000s. So I had a very similar experience where I didn't understand Pokemon. And I have this crystallized memory of seeing a Haunter as my first Pokemon and just being like, what is that? That has to be the most powerful. But.
Yep. Dream Eater, yo.
Yeah. There's just balancing.
Mm-hmm.
Balancing in that Pokemon system makes very little sense. Moving on. Does anyone else. If you don't mind moving on from Pokemon.
No problem.
Does anyone else have any questions for Dr. Faulkner before I get into some of my questions? We're going once. Going twice. Sold. Okay. Moving on. So that doctor title means that you earned your doctorate, which means you had to do a doctorate's thesis, correct?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
What do you specialize in, and what was it on?
Oh, so my specialty area is engineering education research, about researching what are better ways that we can teach engineering so that students learn more, fewer students drop out of school, etc. My specific area of research and my doctoral thesis was about what mathematics actually gets used in engineering, and mapping out, here's the stuff that you learn in a typical across America calculus sequence. Here's the stuff that you use in a very typical introductory circuits and introductory statics courses, and then mapping out, well, how many of the things in this pile also showed up in this pile. And I interviewed 34 engineering faculty in every department except aerospace engineering, because none of them returned my emails. And I just interviewed them saying, what math do you actually use? How do you use math in your discipline? What do you expect your students to know? And then mapping out what gets used when and with what depth.
Was it fairly consistent across the departments?
It was surprisingly consistent. From department to department, and a lot of the stuff that the interviewees said ended up really influencing my present day style as an instructor, which was, you know, you don't need to know the derivative of sine, of cosine, of tangent, of x, because that function doesn't describe anything in our physical universe that I'm aware of. But you really need to know, like, e to the negative 3x. Those were the really simple functions, and knowing that that one starts at some regular size number and then decreases to zero, and it goes to zero, like, really fast. Mm-hmm. Those sorts of being able to connect what is going on in the physical universe to what, you know, oh, this is a 1 over r squared. What does that mean about how the strength of the electric field varies with position, and being able to come to conclusions from that with just the simple functions is the really important stuff. And that was pretty consistent for basically every discipline, including computer science.
And just you saying that had, like, bells ringing in my head as a student that goes here of EE1000, which is very conceptually similar to what you described, where it's a very mathematics-heavy course teaching relationships that are common and the most base level of math that you need to understand what a linear relationship is, what an exponential relationship is, how they would look on a graph, what a graph is.
Oh, yeah. So, the author of the textbook for EE1000, Nathan Klingbeil, I've met him at the American Society for Engineering Education National Summer Conference. I've met up with him, like, every summer for, like, the last 5 years or so now.
Mm-hmm.
And I love that book. There's no other book like it in the world that I've seen before, where I can flip to literally a random page, a random problem from the back of every chapter, and I'm like, oh, I know where this is useful. Oh, I know where this is useful. There's none of the, like, false Sudoku puzzles with resistors in them in the E1000. Like, Dr. Klingbeil's work was a huge influence on my doctoral work, and is currently basically what I want to do is I want to make the same book, but for circuits instead of for introductory engineering math.
Yeah, because the circuits book we're using right now is a lot of the Sudoku puzzle-esque solutions.
I am not a fan of that. I mean, it's I experienced it a lot when I was a student. I remember it most clearly when I was taking linear algebra, but it also occurred in my math methods for physicists course. It also occurred in other classes, but linear algebra is the one where it was like this crystallizing moment. We were talking about, okay, I've got this box, and this box is full of numbers, and then I, like, turn the crank for a while, and I have another box that's full of different numbers, and that's the answer, I guess. And I just remember we were talking about the change of basis, which I know now and I learned later on is good for all sorts of fun and interesting and applicable things. But I just completely dissociated from trying to make sense of any of it. I got an A in the course and I remembered nothing. And then I relearned all of it when I took quantum mechanics, because I was like, what does any of this stuff describe in the universe? And none of that was in the class. And that was just a super frustrating moment for me. And that sort of simmered and simmered and simmered for the next, like, 10 years of my life. And then that became part of my graduate research with, like, applications, and now with what I'm working on for circuits classes.
Okay, that's really fascinating. I don't know how to describe exactly what I'm trying to say right now. Well, give me a second to just resonate on what you just said. Okay. I'm good now. So, if you believe in, if your research shows, first thing, if your research shows that the base mathematics that much of engineering students use is the same, including computer science, and you also believe that education should be applicable, like you were talking about your linear algebra class and how all of this math would be useful, and it was useful when you had to reteach it to yourself for quantum mechanics the second time around. MSOE has a policy where only some engineers can take some sections of courses every quarter depending on their major. What do you think of that system?
I didn't even know that was a thing. So certain sections of calc are reserved for certain majors? Is that what it is?
Yes, it's very odd, and I don't know if it's a victim of the quarter track system.
Yeah, that seems like a scheduling thing, not a... Because I, like, for students to say, like, for example, right now, because I know that EE and computer engineering tracks a little better than, at least on that end of things. Mm-hmm. Like, students who are on track to graduate on time will take EE 2050 DC circuits in the spring, and students in the computer engineering program who are on track to graduate on time take EE 2050 in the fall of their sophomore year.
Yes.
And so certain majors, I think if they have a, there's like, okay, being on track is in a certain place, they get priority for something. That sounds like a scheduling thing. I don't know if that has anything to do with, it sounds like just like a scheduling deal. I don't know anything about that.
So I should probably, everyone in this call has attended or is a works for MSOE or both. So most of you know what the on-track system is, but for the future historians that may eventually watch this, at the Milwaukee School of Engineering in the year 2021, there is a system called the track system. Every major has it, and it's essentially every single course you must take for your major lined up in a flowchart system where classes have prerequisites, co-requisites, sometimes unrelated requisites, and they're just independent courses. But because of the track, it makes it fairly easy for the university to schedule classes in certain quarters. However, because of that system, sometimes only certain classes are taught in certain quarters of the year, or they line up specifically with a certain major, which leads back to what I'm saying, is some classes you need to fill out special forms or they just won't allow you into it at a certain time because that section of that class is designated for a certain major, which can be frustrating for people who are trying to pull ahead classes.
Because you don't have priority if you're ahead.
Yes.
Okay, now I see what you're talking about.
So, and it's for general classes as well. So even statistics, I believe, this quarter, I didn't have a problem because of other reasons, but most of the probability and stats sections were only open to, I want to say, actuarial science and computer science students at first, and then they gradually opened up opened up after a while to other majors. So even general classes can get blocked off.
See, I know when I was a student, it was seniors had priority, but I don't think at least at the university I went to as a student, the University of Idaho, in my hometown of Moscow, Idaho. But it was just seniors had priority, and then things would unlock for them first, and then things unlocked for juniors next. It was just by class standing. And I think because I was in the honors program, I got to, like, I had artificially one extra year seniority for picking.
I believe that's how it works here as well, except instead of years, it's track-based, so you can come in with extra courses already done. You are further ahead on the track. So if you have more credit hours from, let's say, AP classes, since they're the most standard across the nation for racking up college credit, and you come into MSOE, you will have a higher track rank than another student that didn't come in with AP credit. And okay, that's for, yeah. But I just remembered, when you said Idaho, a question that Mr. Hendricks also asked me, which is, what was it like growing up in Idaho?
Well, I played a lot of video games. That is most of my youth was just mostly I played video games. There's really depressingly little to tell because that's basically all I did. I did teach myself to program in a game programming oriented dialect of BASIC called Dark BASIC. And I got that at the hobby shop, and I taught myself to program on that. I made my own little 2D side scrolling bullet hell space shooter. But I have no artistic ability at all, really. So all of the quote-unquote art was just ASCII characters that had been, like, stretched or distorted. So your ship was a brace character that shot equal signs. The bad guys were, like, letter Ds that shot negative signs. So on in that fashion.
There's no shame in using ASCII characters to build a good game.
Dwarf Fortress.
Yes.
Has entered the chat.
Yes.
Yeah, I lived out in the country. I lived about 20 minutes outside of a town of about 20,000 people, Moscow, Idaho, which has a university in it, the University of Idaho again. All the trees are conifers. When I first drove through Wisconsin on my way to graduate school in Illinois, I was like just seeing that many deciduous trees all up close that weren't being, like, carefully maintained by the university groundskeeper was really new for me, because everything is like pines and other conifers in Idaho. So coming to Wisconsin and driving through was like, oh, this looks like Jurassic Park to me.
I can imagine that. I haven't been to Idaho. Fun fact about myself, I've never been west of the Mississippi, but I've been to practically every state east of it.
Hmm.
So
that's a good one third of America's surface.
Yeah, the West is huge.
Yeah, the Mississippi does not cut America in half. It cuts it in one third and two thirds.
Yes, and most of the two thirds is uninhabited. Well.
The population density is
less dense.
Lower.
Yes. It's inhabited, just less densely.
Yeah.
So, what was the weather like in Idaho?
Oh, I know. Idaho's got a very arid climate, so there's no humidity at all. I had never experienced what humidity was until I moved to the Midwest for school. I remember the very first time, when I got into grad school in Illinois, me and my brother and my dad packed up dad's big giant white diesel pickup truck with all of my stuff, and we drove. My dad had only a couple of vacation days, so we drove through the night rotating drivers to get to Illinois as fast as possible. So it was the middle of the night. It was, I don't know, probably 3 a.m, and we had to stop for gas in either, I think, eastern Minnesota or northern Wisconsin was where we had to stop. And I was exhausted, and I wanted a slushie. So I got a slushie, and I was drinking my slushie, and I feel like a wet, cold plop on my leg. I'm like, oh, is this cup leaking? Did I break a hole in this cup? Because I'd never experienced a glass sweating the way they do in humid environments before this moment. And I was like, oh, it's just there's so much condensation from the water in the air that it can actually, like, drip. I'd never experienced that before. So I don't know. It was very arid. Cold, way less of the, like, extreme cold. It's just sort of, like, 60-ish degrees most of the time. And then it gets cold in the winter, but none of the, like, negative 20 with wind chill stuff like I've experienced here in the Midwest.
Is there any of the rapid... I had a teacher in high school that went to the University of Wyoming, which Wyoming is neighbors with Idaho, yeah, of course. And he told me that some days it would feel like you went through all four seasons at once. It would be snowing, then it would be hailing, then it would be raining, then it would be 80 degrees out. Is it similar in Idaho? Does that happen?
No, not really. No, Idaho's generally pretty... Like, when I lived there, I thought that the weather was tempestuous, but I was wrong. The weather in Idaho is pretty tame overall. Like, I'd say, oh, it'd be the next day, it'd be different. But, like, I had never experienced until I moved to the Midwest, like, it's downpouring rain, then sunny, then downpouring rain, then sunny again. And then I'm still 10 miles from home on my bicycle getting rained on a third time. That I never had that happen to me in Idaho, but it happened to me all the time when I moved to the Midwest.
Yeah. I like that. I know I'm going to sound crazy. I like the shifts because it means if you're having a bad day, the day doesn't necessarily, there's a non-zero percent chance that the day will stay bad. It's not guaranteed. And it's not great. It's non-zero.
Yeah. It is a very comforting thing to think of finite non-zero probabilities.
Mm-hmm. Rather, and sometimes, well, I suppose anywhere there's a non-zero percent chance the weather might change, but it's a larger probability in the Midwest.
It's non-negligible.
Yes. Certainly. Going back to education, which we kind of spiraled off on our tangent about Idaho and weather, you went to, I believe, the University of Illinois, UC?
Yep, Urbana-Champaign.
And I remember briefly, like incredibly briefly, you said you did not enjoy the size down there, as if...
Oh, not a fan. So the University of Idaho, I was a physics student as an undergrad, and there's like 10 physics faculty. So I was on a first name basis with, you know, everyone. Mm-hmm. Maybe not everyone preferred to be called by their first name, but like all of the professors in the physics department would like recognize my face, which is, you know, similar to, like here, the EE program, we've got, I think, 15 full-time EE faculty, getting to know professors is like a normal and expected thing.
Yeah.
And just, you know, someone would notice if the class started and my seat did not have a butt in it. Someone would know. And then I went to Illinois Urbana-Champaign, which is a campus that is 50-something thousand students. Saying it with more precision than that means that you have to like say, well, oh, well, exactly how many of this kind of sort of student do you even count? 50 something thousand is the most precise you can really be. It's huge. It's like a, 2 mile by 2 mile block.
Yeah. It fuels the central Illinois economy on its own.
Basically on its own. Yeah. And so it's humongous, and even graduate students just get lost in the crowd and are just basically just a number. And then there's just like a seething throng of undergraduate students.
Mm-hmm.
And one time when I was in grad school, I didn't show up for work for 2 weeks, and nobody even noticed. Like, no one even noticed that I just didn't show up. I didn't say anything, didn't say I was taking a vacation. I just got, I think I would identify it now as depressed or burnt out. And I just didn't show up, and nobody noticed or seemed to care or commented on it at all. And going from the sort of warm student-focused environment at University of Idaho, to the U of I, University of Illinois, it was like leaving grandma's house and you close the door behind you and you realize that it's really cold and you forgot your jacket and the door is locked and grandma doesn't have her hearing aids in and you're just stuck in this cold, lonely place. And I figured out pretty early on I did not want to work at a big school. I wanted to work at a small school where, like, close contact between students and faculty is the expectation.
I've heard, I've also been down there because I'm from Illinois, and that, I'm going to give you my perspective now, just personally.
Yeah.
U of I, for everyone in my high school, including myself, was that... Well, I was different because I was trying to get into their engineering program as an undergrad, which is pretty high ranked.
It's competitive.
Yeah. And fun fact, U of I, like you said, is such a large school that it's very difficult to get anything from them in the basis of aid. And it's so... highly desired. Like, if you have a child in Illinois that's going to U of I, then it's like you're part of a massive special club. And because of that, U of I hands out very little aid to a lot of people, which is actually one of the reasons I got turned off from it. The other reason was it's size was, like you said, just huge. I could not comprehend being there, basically.
Yeah, it's, I mean, it is a huge school, and it's a very research intensive school. There are definitely, like, people I know there who are really passionate, dedicated teachers, and there are other people there who are less concerned about their teaching.
More concerned on selling a product of sorts?
Research. Like,
research.
There's,
okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Did you do any... Well, I know you did the education research. What other research did you really do down there as a grad student?
So I originally went there to study electricity and magnetism because I took my junior year electromagnetics class as an undergrad and I just fell head over heels for the subject. I'm like, this is going to be my thing. I petitioned out of taking senior laboratory to take more EMAG courses. Like, I was like, this is going to be my thing. And then I picked which grad schools I applied to and which one I accepted based on how much electromagnetics and antenna stuff do they have there. And then I did EMAG stuff for a little while, and then my relationship with my graduate advisor didn't work out. And so I left that group and I joined a different group that was even worse. And then I left that group, and I was on the lam for a couple of months. I still had a little bit of fellowship money left over, so I had a little bit of time to find a new advisor before dropping out of graduate school. And based on, like, I don't know, the equivalent of like rolling 4 natural 20s in a row, like random favorable coincidences, I landed in the research group that I ultimately got my PhD with.
That's very lucky.
It was like, if I hadn't happened to got to know this one person and didn't happen to have thought about this one thing and then didn't happen to have talked to this person that was literally retiring later that week, who told me about another I mean, if not for just fantastic lucky coincidences, I would have dropped out of grad school and, I don't know, taught English in Korea or something. I don't know.
Speaking, I actually have a question. What is fellowship money, and can you explain the grad school funding process?
Yeah, so in grad school, there are 3 kinds of money, and they're listed in, I'm going to list them in decreasing order of desirability. So most desirable, so starting at the bottom is a TA, teaching assistant. Those are the least desirable because you want to be done with grad school and none of the stuff you do as a TA gets your thesis done. I liked teaching, but I also didn't like being in grad school. I had a TA position for a little bit, but I was mostly on research stuff. So the second is research assistant, which is your stipend gets paid out of research money from the NSF or the Department of Energy or whatever. And you get paid to do research on some specific project, which may or may not be the thing you're doing your thesis on. If you're lucky, then they can be the same. But sometimes you have to do research on a project that you don't really like in order to have a paycheck. And then you spend the other half of your time doing research on the thing that you're getting done for your PhD. And then the most desirable kind of funding is fellowship, which is you just get directly funded by, mine came from the Department of Defense. It's the it's a now shuttered program called NDSEG for students who were doing research relevant to the defense industry, where you get your stipend and you can do whatever research you want, and you don't need to have a specific project. That's the most desirable one. And I had a 1-year fellowship that I got at the very beginning, and then I got NDSEG for another couple of years, and I had that ran out right around when I switched groups.
Okay. I did not know any of that. That was very useful to know. I'm considering doing grad school, but I know very little. Particularly because no one, I know a total of 1 person prior to coming here who has any doctorate in the engineering fields, and he was a material science physics major, worked at Argonne National Lab.
Yes.
So.
Yeah. Grad school, here's the hard facts about grad school. Is if you already have a bachelor's of science in engineering, then getting a PhD in engineering will reduce your lifetime earnings by approximately $1 million over the course of your career, because you're spending an extra 5 years in a low-wage position when you could be working as just, you know, getting your first engineering job. And you're like, oh, wait a minute, but like entry-level salary isn't that much. No, no, no. The years of your career that you sacrifice on the altar of academia are the 5 years at the end of your career when you're a senior project manager 3 and you're making $200,000 a year. Those are the years that are given up when you delay the start of your career. You have 5 fewer years that are in your working lifespan. And unless the thing that you know in your heart is your destiny, that this is what you need to do, you need to be a college professor, you need to be, you know, doing cutting edge research in a national lab, or doing like, you know, next generation R&D for Intel.
Mm-hmm.
Unless you know that you won't be happy with a more regular position, then don't go to grad school unless it's worth $1 million to you. I love what I do for a living. I love being a professor. I'm stoked every day about what I do. I think that prorated over the course of my career, I will make more than $1 million worth of hedonic value of enjoying what I do for a living. Unless you know that the thing that you want to do requires a PhD, don't go. Just go get a job, maybe get a master's if your company's going to pay for it, and just don't get a PhD unless you know. You know, it is like, it's like being a pastor. If you can do anything else, do that. But if you hear the call, you have to go.
Mm-hmm.
And I think a PhD is the same way. If you hear the call, you have no choice. But unless you know you want to be a researcher at a national lab, or you know you want to be a college level professor, then it's not worth the sacrifices.
Is that partially the reason why there's so much funding into specific students who want to go for that doctorate and do the cutting edge research by U.S. higher departments?
I mean, the funding is just there because, well, the government wants research to happen, so you pay people to do it. But you get paid not a lot. So as a graduate student, if you're a graduate student in engineering, you should be getting paid. If you're paying them, they didn't want you there, really.
Yes.
Like, because you should be doing research.
Sorry to interrupt, but I heard someone describe it to me once as a very bohemian lifestyle.
Yeah. Your paycheck in engineering at the University of Illinois, when I was on fellowship money, giving all the specific qualifiers and asterisks, is I lived on $2,000 a month about, which is, you make around $20,000 a year, which is survivable. And if you're a student, you probably don't have a family to support, but it's certainly one fourth of what you'd be making in industry with the same education.
And that's at the start, not even counting the final 5 years, as you said.
That's just comparing your grad school bohemian stipend to the entry level job salary that all the other people you went to school with are earning if they're working at a company.
All right. Well, it's getting close to 7 p.m., Dr. Faulkner. Usually we take a one-song break or two-song break, whatever lasts to 7:05. So if you have anything you want to do starting at 7, just start thinking about it now.
All right.
But continuing on, before we go to break, I'm going to ask anyone in the broadcast if they have any questions about the grad school spiel that we just went on, or anything that they want to ask Dr. Faulkner in general. Doesn't appear to be so. Oh, wait, no, we have a typer.
Do you have any, clever mnemonics or anything for linear algebra?
Mnemonics for remembering procedures, or do you mean, can you be more specific?
Yeah, I don't know. Like, I don't like some way to remember all the theorems and connect them together.
Oh, so I think the only thing that would have helped me would be ask some of your EE professors, hey, can you give me literally any example of why I should care about change of basis? Can you give me any example of why I should care about eigenvalues? So if you're like, because for me, the thing that made it hard for me was I don't know what the point of calculating an eigenvalue is. So it's really hard to remember how to do it since I don't really know what it represents. But then I'd say, oh, well, an eigenvalue, one example of an eigenvalue in nature is the principal axes of rotation of some object. So if you have something like a satellite, its moment of inertia is described by some matrix that's how inclined is it to rotate about, you know, any given arbitrary axis. And then you do a couple integrals and you get this box with 9 numbers in it. And then if you diagonalize that and get its eigenvalues and eigenvectors, the eigenvectors are the 3 principal axes that that object like naturally wants to rotate about. And the eigenvalues are the moment of inertia about that axis. Whichever one is the biggest, the principal eigenvalue, is the one that is most physically important, because that's the axis that in the presence of energy dissipation, like if it's a satellite, the thin, wispy upper atmosphere, it'll eventually, if you just wait, it can start spinning any old random which way, and it will eventually rotate about that axis. So I'd say ask some of your EE professors, what are some things in nature or in technology that use this stuff, and that might make it easier to remember.
Okay, thanks.
All right. And with that, we're going to go on a break to probably 7:05 and then be right back with... Excuse me, I didn't hear that.
All right.
Okay, cool. I'm going to this song. Let's see what it will be. Indians come
top, they can be so cruel. Heard California was a place to start brand new. So she left that dust bowl town. Sometimes when alone, when house, I wonder where we'd be if I never scored that last touchdown. Summer, the wonder, the hunger, and the sound of distant thunder. Indian summer.
The best country songs are love songs, and I ship you with this next one. I'm John Shields III, and you're listening to 101.1 FM WJEB.
Welcome back to Smooth Sailing on WJEB Radio 101.1 FM. I am Captain Jackson, and I am here with Dr. Faulkner.
Hello.
Dr. Faulkner, we have one question from the previous half of the show, which is from, again, the technician himself, Mitch Hendricks. Is the Champaign-Urbana area that good of a place to live?
Champaign's great. I do not miss grad school at all. I miss the town of Champaign. It punches way above its weight in terms of amenities. The Champaign metropolitan area has about 150,000 inhabitants. When the students are in session, there's, I don't know, 100-ish permanent townies. And there is way better restaurants, way better art stuff. There's several very nice, friendly local game stores. Champaign is for me as a student, it was a great place to live. I was super happy, the bus system in Champaign is amazing. It has more riders per year than Indianapolis, which is a metro area, 10 times the population. The bus in Champaign is great. And if you're a student there, or a grad student, if you're a grad student there, then you can go, you get a free bus card and you can take the bus for free. There's lots and lots of routes that go to all the useful places. It's a great little town. And oh man, if you like Chinese food, there is a lot of really good Chinese food there.
He's not in the call, but I believe that answers his question. Mitch has, if I remember correctly, he thought it was a bad area. I might be wrong there.
Oh, okay. He says he's
he's listening
on the airwaves there.
We have a very bad transmitter, if you didn't know this. I'm not sure if it's awful. It used to reach farther than it does now. Our max used to be, we used to be able to get to the science building. Now we can...
to actually reach the highway almost.
Nice.
From MLH. But now we barely get across the street, yes.
Yeah, Dr. Meyer was complaining because he couldn't listen to us in his car right outside the building.
What's the wattage on your transmitter?
I don't think we watered it down at all, right, Bilkey?
The wattage itself is rated at 0.02 watts.
Nice.
So about double a Wi-Fi router.
Yeah.
For amateur radio, I think the legal limit is 60 watts, I think, if you've got a license. I looked it up one time. I think it's 60, like a 60 watt dipole is... If you radiate more than that, the FCC comes and takes your transmitter away.
So a licensed operator can actually do up to 1,500 watts.
Oh, nice.
Yeah.
Okay, I must have been looking at a certain band.
I am currently not. Although for about 2 years now, I've been on the executive board of the Amateur Radio Club at MSOE. I still have not gotten my license. Although I did pass the practice tests, I just haven't gone around to actually getting tested.
Nice.
It's also a cost thing, though we could throw money into it. I'd be willing to throw money into a better transmitter, Bilkey.
Yeah, I guess something to consider over the summer.
Yeah.
Just need a bigger RF power amplifier.
Yeah. Well, Bilkey tried to make his own.
I remember seeing that on the Discord.
I believe...
Yeah, it was pretty wild. Those, a lot of the parts in tech support are not made for high frequency.
No. because RF is just crazy, because, radio frequency stuff, circuit theory just stops being true. And all the parts, all the stuff at tech support is great for like power electronics in the kilohertz range. But once you get up in the radio range, it's like, oh, the breadboard itself is a capacitor. So there's that.
For the non-EE people, do you want to explain what you mean when you say radio frequency?
So the electromagnetic spectrum is broken up into general blocks of basically all the numbers from 0 to infinity are a frequency in total cycles per second. Less than one cycle per second is like human breathing signals and stuff. And you have something in regular cycles per second, like 60 cycles per second is the power line frequency in the United States and Canada. It's a good speed for mechanical motion. You go higher, you get into audio frequencies, which is in the lower thousands of cycles per second. Then you get into millions or billions of cycles per second, and that's radio. And then you can keep going, and then you get into trillions of cycles per second, and you start getting into infrared, and then 10 to the even bigger number, you get into visible light, ultraviolet light, X-rays, gamma rays, and then crazy shenanigan physics, cosmic rays, at the holy cow, this number is so big number of cycles per second.
Too many cycles.
So 10 to the some pretty big number.
Yeah. And the problem with our tech is that we just simply can't get that high with the power that we're using, which is, like John Bilkey said, only double that of your average Wi-Fi router.
Yeah. A normal Wi-Fi router is like 9 milliwatts, right?
Yeah. So, if we could just get something a bit more.
So a Wi-Fi router is typically 100 milliwatts, and we're at 200. Yeah.
Okay. Continuing on, we're gonna move off of the topic since it's been practically the first half of our entire program. Dr. Faulkner, I'm aware that you very much enjoy the tabletop gaming profession. And D&D in specific.
Yeah.
And if you even referenced rolling 4 nat 20s earlier in the show. Mr. Hendricks asked earlier today, what's your favorite class in D&D?
My favorite class is playing as all of the dragons and orcs as the dungeon master. Mm-hmm. But if I'm not DMing, I have two main character types that I like to play. I like to play either a barbarian who has like one shtick, like he's got a axe that can talk or something, like, so where I just like hit stuff, or I have like one really like simple but flexible power. Like I had a paladin that worshipped the gods of art and crafting, and his special thing was he had a special lump of clay called the Clay of Creation that it, with, you know, if you say the magic word and touch it and you're a paladin of the gods of artifice, then it can instantly transform into anything it's been sculpted into ever before, and it's passed down from paladin to paladin over generations and whatnot. So either I have that character, they've got one somewhat flexible shtick, and then that's the end of it, or I like to play a character who's a spellcaster who has just like a ridiculous number of little fiddly bits and material components. And I played a priestess of the gods of the deep, like an ocean cleric, that like all the different gods of the deep had different things that they wanted that were often contradictory. I'm like, oh, well, see, but I ate meat yesterday, so I don't have my healing spell today. I have divine fire today, but I don't have healing because I ate meat yesterday.
That is an intro. I'm going to need to steal that. I'm sorry. Okay. And how many are these like because that specifically the Paladin one,
mm-hmm.
and how in depth you got into detail with that character, is that a character that you've used for a long time?
Oh, that was a character that I used in a campaign back in grad school that that was for one campaign. I think I had that character for a year and a half before I left that group.
Mm-hmm. How long has your longest group ran? I also know that, you said, your favorite thing is the DM. But
yeah, I think my longest campaign went for just about two and a half years. We had a campaign in Eberron where the party were sort of scoundrels that like they were sort of very basically all Han Solo, except one of them's a Kanku and one of them's a Fire Ganassi and whatever, but they basically they're all scoundrel smuggler types, and we just went around Eberron doing various scoundrelly things. They ended up taking over the drug trade in Sharn at one point.
This sounds like one of my games, what it eventually always devolves into.
Yep.
At some point, okay, D&D, and you're a DM, and I often say this on this podcast whenever I talk about D&D, almost feels to me as the final full circle evolution of human storytelling, as in we went from folk tales handed down to writing down the stories back to speaking folk tales essentially, but with math.
Yeah, the thing about D&D that I realized is the reason that we have the dice and the books and the rules and the let's go on the forums and see whether these two rules interact in the way that we think they do is, basically to have some self-control. Because if you go back when you were 6 years old and you were playing make-believe, you didn't need any dice or rules. You just made it up as you went. You're like, pew, pew, I shot you. And then you fall over. And then this, pew, pew, I shot you. Well, I've got super armor. Well, my bullets go through super armor. And when that, once you, as children, you realize that you can say anything you want in a say anything you want and it's true game. If you don't have any self-control, which you probably don't when you're 9, then you can very easily ruin the fun for everyone. And we have this structure of dice and books and rules to prevent the no, I have super armor problem.
Mm-hmm.
So that way we can all participate in a shared story without anyone taking more than their own share of the spotlight, right?
Yes and no. I disagree there for one fundamental reason, and that's I've had Mitch Hendricks as a player. And Mitch, in all accounts of the word, plays the inverse power fantasy. As in, he plays extremely average people that have superhuman wills and just don't care about their surroundings. So, as in, he will be a normal man, and he'll have a vampire hunting him down, but he simply will not care about the vampire, because he just doesn't care about the vampire.
Excellent.
Mitch as a player, and his most iconic character he's ever had, also his longest played character, was in the 5th edition module, Curse of Strahd.
Ah, yes.
And he played a chaotic evil fighter that was a pyromaniac, and his name was just Phil, and he was just an average guy. And Phil was a monster arguably more worse than Strahd himself, because Phil simply didn't care about order. There was no peace wherever Phil went.
I'm playing in an all-warlock campaign in Curse of Strahd right now, actually.
Really?
So all the player characters are warlocks, and we're in Curse of Strahd, and our game master's father just died, so we haven't played in a few weeks. But
how are you feeling about that?
I feel sorry for him. Like, he's, you know, it was a, like, he had...
No, I was like, referring to the all warlock party.
Oh, all warlock is great. I'm playing a lurker in the deep warlock. I get to summon tentacles. I took Simic hybrid so I can climb walls. Mostly I just pew-pew things with my Eldritch Blast, and then I've got some out-of-combat powers like jump. I love jump. I think jump is probably my favorite spell in 5th ed. I just like jump. Like, I want to be able to jump up to a third-story building.
I like shape jump. Water.
Ah.
I really, really enjoy shape water. I think it might be... I've played every edition except 4th, because I played tabletop, but I didn't start with D&D. I started with a weird system that was very make-believe, as in there were very little rules, and the DM and the player were essentially on equal power in DMing. And then I went to Gamma World.
Oh, Gamma World is crazy.
Yeah. Oh, you know about Gamma World?
Yeah, I ran a couple of, I think a 3-session long thing in Gamma World when I was in my first year in grad school. Gamma World is bananas.
Gamma World is not balanced whatsoever, but it's about the story anyways.
Yeah.
So there doesn't necessarily need to be balance in Gamma World, especially when you're talking about tribal civilizations of cacti fighting genetic super soldiers with ARs.
Yep, yep.
Which is what makes that system so fun. And then the person that introduced me to Gamma also introduced me to D&D. First edition. I started on 1st.
What?
And 2nd. What?
You started on, like, Advanced Dungeons & Dragons?
Yes. I started on Advanced Dungeons & Dragons. This was a second-generation DM. His name was Adam. And Adam inherited the books from his parents, who have a 30-year-long universe that is still running to this day.
Wow.
And I got to play in essentially the second wave of storytelling in that campaign, which was run by The Sun for a brief campaign, and it was fantastic. Still set in Greyhawk 30 years later, same universe.
Nice.
Started in 1st.
So that's like the PCs from the first couple of years are now like figures of legend that are in the long past at this point.
Not even that far behind. So major plot events, like a campaign starts out with the world, there's a great famine. Well, that great famine was caused by one player in a campaign that happened 10 years ago that is subsequently going on with the one that you're in currently. Except you're a first level PC. Or this civil war is about to break out and the player characters don't know it, but the civil war already happened in every event and it happened 3 years ago in a different campaign.
Nice.
And it's, they have a multiple filing cabinets and about a 10-foot by 10-foot map of Greyhawk.
Oh, yeah.
Just on this massive rollable stand, essentially. It was fantastic. I loved every second of it. especially because their first edition rules took out some of the... They essentially spun D&D into their own version of D&D.
Mm-hmm.
So when it moved past second edition, which was the end of Advanced Dungeons & Dragons in its form, they just decided, okay, let's take out some of the weird rules from first edition, like changing attributes based on gender or not allowing certain races to be certain things. So keeping some of the modernization in their own version, but still keeping it very hardcore AD&D.
Yeah.
Which, honestly, is my favorite edition. Their homebrew edition, fixed first is what I've been calling it.
Yeah.
It was great. I really liked it. And then I played third edition for a couple sessions, and I've run everything I've ran in fifth.
Yeah, I started playing my last year of college. I started playing in fourth edition, and then I moved over to, so the lead designer of third ed and the lead designer of fourth edition, Rob Heinsoo and Jonathan Tweet, got together to make a game called 13th Age that I think is, takes the best parts of both of them and smushes them together and adds a good helping of like narrativistic stuff similar to some like the small press games like Fate. And I've been running that since, I've been running 13th Age since, I think for about 8 years at this point, now that I think about it.
Is there still updates to it, or has it kind of settled down?
I think it's pretty much settled down. The thing I really like about it is the skill system is really elegant. So instead of, so like if you're playing 3-5 and you want to be a rogue, right? So you've got to, all right, well, I want to be Master Thief, right? So I need pick lock and pick pocket and move silently and sneak and spot and use magic device and use rope and like 11,000 other things. Yeah. When you already know like what your character's shtick is, he's a thief. He does thief stuff. So in 13th Age, the way the skill system works is you get a background and you just write Master Thief +4. And then anytime you try to do a thing that a Master Thief would know how to do, you add 4. And that's the system.
Because it's a story at heart.
Yeah. So then anytime you want to do a skill check, it's a like negotiation between the player and the GM of, well, does your background count for this? And so there's some things like, well, my background is Master Thief, and I want to steal the keys from this guard to get into that dungeon, then obviously it counts.
Mm-hmm.
And then if you're like, well, I'm a Master Thief, and I want to decipher ancient runes, obviously you don't get your +4, because that's not something that's in the wheelhouse of being a Master Thief. And then whenever things were like marginal, my rule was, well, if you can make up a story on the spot about how your character's previous life experience made, you know, this part of their background relevant to the task that you want to do, I'll give it to you if you can make up a story that makes sense on the spot. So I had a character that they were trying to rescue one of the other PCs who fell into like a raging river, and they wanted to like lasso them out. And their character's background was Clockwork Knight. And I'm like, I don't buy that Clockwork Knight gives you access to lassoing. He's like, oh, no. Each and every one of the Clockwork Knights are handpicked by the Dwarf King from ranch hands who drive mechanical oxen up to the dwarven city of Forge to be melted down into dwarven arms and armor. I'm like, okay, that's a thing that your character could do. Lassoing is part of what it means to be a Clockwork Knight.
Okay. Oh, no, that's, I like that. I really like that. That's another thing that I'm going to have to steal for some system.
Yeah, it's because it rewards your system.
in my boat as a DM, and I don't know if you have the same sentiment, if you can, you should reward your players for playing the character and not diverting back to just playing themselves.
Yeah.
And that system that you just described of rewarding your player characters for building the world and building who this person is and building the story and rewarding them with bonuses, essentially the laser gun from your imagination fight, is a really fascinating way of just meshing everything together. I really like that.
I think it's something that a lot of old school game masters don't really get, but like, you're not J.R.R. Tolkien.
No.
You are not a storyteller, and the PCs are not audience members. We are all co-storytellers, and the game master has the burden of also being the referee to make sure that the way you have fun and the way that you have fun don't come into conflict with each other, right?
That's right. And I've had DMs who've tried to be Tolkien. Like, I've had people retcon sessions or say, no, you can't do that. And those people, like you said, are having a hard time understanding that the main characters of their story are the people sitting right in front of you. None of your characters should be front and center, which is very interesting when you consider the general scape of movies and books and the saying that the villain should, a good story is only as good as its villain. Well, no, not necessarily in D&D. You can have a game where you can have a character study on the player characters, and that's the event. You don't need a villain. You as the storyteller don't need to put anything out there necessarily for your players except your environment.
I had a very railroady game master that, you know, thought he was J.R.R. Tolkien. And so my character was a Kender Wild Mage. So just chaos incarnate. And he's like, you know, super optimistic and naive and like does whatever. And then Wild Surge, roll on the Wild Surge table. Well, it looks like we're being teleported in a random direction 500 miles away. And so whatever was happening in the story isn't happening anymore, because we're in a completely different nation at this point. And he put my character on the bus because it messed with his plans too much, because he liked to plan things out months in advance, and having something that he didn't have control over just messed with the way he wanted to play, which was dice-based Mad Libs, that like what's going to happen is already prescribed. And it's, I hit with a weapon name underneath the blank, and it does something in the blank. Like, it was just very fill in the blank, but, you know, with dice instead of regular Mad Libs adjectives.
But do you think there's a point where a bit of going back to the very first thing you said, isn't there a point where you have to start? No. Okay. I'm arguing with myself now between two ways of thought, and I want your input on this. The first way is you can be a DM that plays by the rules of their universe for the upper limits of what the players can do, or you can be a DM that plays by the upper limits of the rule book. And what you're implying is you should be, the rule book are the upper limits and not necessarily the universe itself.
I think that depends on how how much you trust the rule book. I think you should have rules. Some of them can be house rules, like fourth edition, the ritual system was terrible because it made all of the neat out of combat magic like mud to stone unusable. And so like, well, we're going to change the rules and then we're going to play by those rules. I think, and then like, you know, as game master, you always have discretion for saying, I think that, you know, in this specific situation, we're going to make an exception to this rule. But I think that that's starting with good rules that you think describe things. And then you're like, well, oh, it doesn't match the world. Well, then patch the rules saying, oh, in our game universe, Dragonborn get to use fire breath as many times as they want because that's the way I want my universe to be. And then now that's the rule. It's not the rules in the book, but it's the rules that we are all mutually agreeing to play with.
I guess then the only question I would have on that train of thought is there ever any point in which, well, first I have to ask a precursor question is, how do you handle when you have to be a mean DM, when you have to target the players because they're doing something that the society wouldn't like? Or they're making enemies would be a good way to put it.
I guess when I need to do something like that, I make sure that the players know that this thing is going to be a consequence. Your character, you know, in the world knows ahead of time this course of action that you're about to take will have consequences, and your character who inhabits this universe knows what they are. Or like it's like when I normally, you know, nice GM, monsters don't attack downed players. And then I say, and most monsters don't. But these are ghouls. Mm-hmm. If any player goes unconscious, all ghouls will disengage, take as many opportunity attacks as you can dish out, and then all try to eat the guy on the ground. You know that ghouls are this way. You were told the stories as children. Ghouls are not messing around. If you go down, all of the ghouls will try to eat you and you'll be dead, not unconscious.
Mm-hmm.
I think as long as players know there's going to be a consequence of, oh yeah, like you chose to, you know, burn that bridge down to keep someone from escaping, but now the bridge is burned down and everyone in the village hates you, but you knew that when you did it, and I told you, so now your characters have to figure out a way to, like, still get by when everyone hates them.
And then, is there ever a point, okay, let's say you had a party that understood all of that, and just out of sheer entertainment value, kept going further and further until virtually everyone hated them. Is there ever a point to go, okay, this is the point where society turns on you and actively wants the party dead. This is nearing the end of the story. This is how it's playing out.
Yeah, at that point, I think it's because I think another thing that a lot of GMs don't realize or realize too late is the game master is a player too. And if you're the game master, you should... Your job is to safeguard the fun of everyone at the table, and you are one of the every at the table, and your fun also counts. You're not the only person whose fun counts, but if you as the game master, like, I don't want to run that story. I'm not going to have fun playing a game where the players are just wantonly making everything terrible all the time. I don't want to run that game. So like, hey, like if you guys want to keep doing this, I don't want to run this campaign. If someone else wants to step in and be game master, we can keep doing this line of things, but I don't want to this isn't the kind of, you know, we, you know, sort of agreed at the beginning of the campaign that we're going to be, this is the general, you know, part of the story universe that we're going to be occupying. And I don't want to run the game where you're just, that's not a story I want to spend work constructing.
Mm-hmm. I should have done that once. That's lesson learned.
Yeah.
Lesson learned. It was I was asking for it. I knew what I signed up for. I thought it was going to go a bit differently when they all decide to make evil characters.
Oh, yeah. Evil campaigns, you need to have either the expectation that it's only going to last two or three sessions, and it's mm-hmm. not really a campaign, or you need to really be able to trust everyone at the table that you're all, you know, trying to have fun with a certain kind of story. And I don't think I've had a game group where I trusted everyone not to be actively ruining the other players' fun, and not mm-hmm. just like if one character has something bad happen to them, like, well, yeah, it's not a story unless some bad things happen. But we played a couple sessions with a lawful evil group that could get by. But I think the all evil ends up being, it degenerates into PvP and people getting hurt feelings almost immediately.
I had the opposite experience, honestly.
Really?
Yes, I had a pirate game. They were all pirates. They had a boat. And I kept throwing treasure opportunities at them. And they just decided, we are pirates. We are chaotic. We're going to do whatever we want in this universe and take every story hint we throw at you and yep. just throw it to the wind. And I would keep throwing hints at them or like plot lines.
Yeah.
And they would keep looking at the, keep going, look at the plot line, say, no, we're not going to do this. Push it to the side. Play for like 2 hours and go, what were we doing?
Yeah, that's definitely a, we need to talk as a group about what kind of story we all want to be telling together. Like, yeah, you want to be pirates, cool. But if you just want to like hack and slash ancient skeletons and get treasure, then just play Sea of Thieves. I don't have yeah. to do any prep, and we can just play Sea of Thieves.
Yes. There were ways I could have gone about that. It was highly entertaining in hindsight, but it was very frustrating for me as the GM player.
Yeah.
That made sense. And I should have stepped back and found some way to do what I wanted to do, because at that point, what they wanted to do was very, very absurd, and they were basically just saying, what's the funniest thing we could do for a minute with this insane group of pirates? Like, they found a bunch of crabs, and they made the crabs into a, like, bound them with rope into a platform, and they called it the Crab Steva, or the Chevy Crabalier. And they were riding it around, and the crabs died from exhaustion, essentially. And they decided, we want to go to the 9th level of hell and get those crabs back. And they were a 2nd level party, and I just had to roll with this 2nd level party saying that, having no idea in character where to go to do that. And me also not knowing where to go to do that. And it was pure insanity.
Yeah, that's...
It was
that's
funny
a,
in hindsight, but it yeah. was frustrating.
Yeah. Because I know I had a, you know, sometimes I've had conflicts with, you know, players or with other people who were the GM when I was a player, that's like some it's some people, you, they want to play a certain kind of narrative that not everyone's on the same page. And sometimes it's because, like there's a fundamental contradiction between games like Call of Cthulhu and Dungeons & Dragons, because the idea of D&D is that you are a extraordinary individual doing extraordinary things. It's a power fantasy, whereas Call of Cthulhu is you're a regular person who's like a janitor who is caught up in a supernatural situation beyond their control and understanding. It's a powerlessness fantasy. And those can both be fun. You can play something like All Flesh Must Be Eaten or whatever, where you're a normal person in the zombie apocalypse. And those can be a fun experience, but it's a very different part of the narrative landscape than, you know, Warriors of Light saving the world from the Dark Lord. Those are both fun stories, but you all need to be on the same page. And like, at least for me, like, when it seems like the game is degenerating into self-parody in the second session, that it's all jokes all the time and nothing is really happening. It's like, is D&D even the right game to do this? Like, we can do this shenanigans all the time, but maybe it should be Gamma World, which the expectation is that nothing makes sense and is crazy all the time.
Yes.
And so you don't have the expectation of there being all this sort of D&D Warriors of Light stuff, because it's Gamma World and you're negotiating with, you know, the half squirrel, half octopus laser people.
I wanted to do something in Gamma World this year. Unfortunately, it never worked out because I was just too busy.
Mm-hmm.
Post-apocalyptic Milwaukee.
Oh, that would be fun.
And
yeah.
Because we're at the highest part of Milwaukee, like Michigan, Lake Michigan has consumed the entirety of Milwaukee except the campus, and the campus is now ruled by Rosie and her robots, her riveters.
Yeah, a little bit of Fallout. That'd be fun. Dibs, the guy who makes all the shish kebabs.
Yes.
I loved Fallout 3 because I loved the crafted items.
Mm-hmm.
And like in Fallout New Vegas, I just played it took me a while to find like a playstyle that was satisfying for me, because it felt like, you know, once you get the power and the Gatling laser, like there's just no drama left in the game at all. Like everything is just so easy that it doesn't feel rewarding when you do anything. So I made a character that had an endurance of 1 and tanked all of their weapon skills down to the minimum value except explosives.
Mm-hmm.
And then that guy ran around looking for ingredients to make turbo, because bullet time is amazing.
I like New Vegas. I also have very fond memories of New Vegas, because New Vegas is one of the only computer RPGs, maybe RPGs in general, and video games where I know of you can kill everything.
Mm-hmm.
It is an amazing story, the development of that game, because it was made essentially in 9 months. It was a rushed product, and they managed to make just something incredible. But going off of that tangent, I understand maybe a bit better now that I should have ran something a bit more obviously wacky for that group.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm, in fact, running with that group again, plus one player that's even more chaotic. And I've made it very obvious that we're doing D&D, and it's going to be wacky from the get-go, which hopefully will solve a lot of my issues. And I've also made it very obvious that this is a opener game, and I'm not going to hold anything back.
Yeah. Well, if you know that that's what you're working with, just go Funhouse Dungeon and mm-hmm. say, all right, you guys just want to do wacky shenanigans. You don't want to have a long story. So just say you guys are in a dungeon. You're there because there's treasure at the bottom, I guess. And then just have it full of rooms with random shenanigans. And, all right, well, this is the gravity flipping room. And then we go on to the next one, and there's a little dungeon town. And then you can, like, interact with them. But then once you leave, the door closes behind you. So you can just keep moving on. And then that can keep things constrained enough that that it's not nearly as much work for you to keep making content that will then just become completely obliterated.
Yeah, I had a mentality up until the obliteration, the obliteration sessions, which the only reason they stopped was because COVID happened.
Yeah.
It was, I want to make a serious setting, and I'll allow my... And I know all my characters, my main characters, are going to be wacky. So I'm going to make all these serious people and have a bunch of wacky characters in it. And that meshed well with... It meshed well until a turning point. And the turning point was... one player in specific who I fear.
You know.
One of my good friends, but... Crazy smart as well. Crazy smart guy. But, yeah, that was the turning point. Well,
yeah.
This has been an interesting conversation, but it looks like it's about time, Dr. Faulkner.
All right. Well, thank you very much for having me on your show as your season finale guest.
No problem. This was a fun episode for sure. Once again... To all the viewers listening out there, this has been Smooth Sailing, the season finale on WJAB Radio 101.1 FM. Thank you, Dr. Faulkner, for being my guest during the season finale. We will now be signing off for the summer as our station technician, Mitchell Hendricks, takes down our very weak transmitter. And I stop making these during the summer. We will return with Smooth Sailing 2 TOO next year for our third season. Until then, farewell. I am about to depart the dock for the summer. The first light.